I'm Marcus Buck Bagwell, and you're listening to the Phantom Squad Podcast.
Hey everyone, this is going to be a special episode of the Phantom Squad Podcast. We are live in the DDP Yoga Studios here with Mr. Buff Bagwell. How's it going, man?
Man, I'm doing great, bro. Thanks so much for having me on here, man.
Thank you for coming on.
I love it, man. It's really great to see guys that are in their 20s that are so excited about business and about the wrestling business alone, but also just about just somebody out trying to better their lives with a great podcast going on, man. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. And again, as you guys heard last episode, I'm here with my best friend, Ryan, as my co-host today. How's it going, man?
What's going on?
Awesome. Awesome. Now, the first thing I wanted to ask you, so how did you, I know a lot of people go into indies. How did you, you know, get into wrestling, or was that, because I know it was a lot different back. It wasn't all over the television like it is nowadays.
It was so different, man. First of all, there wasn't any like wrestling school. Well, even before there was even the word wrestling in my life, there was sports. I was all about sports, all about football, baseball. I was in 1980, I was the Golden Glove, the Georgia Golden Glove State Boxing Champion. So that'd been at the 82. I was 12 years old, 82. So I was real athletic. I was always into sports, football, baseball, boxing. I wrestled also for years. But then when I got to high school, I focused just on football and baseball. And it was three sports in high school was just too much. I wanted to be big. I wanted to gain weight. And you couldn't do that with wrestling. You had to lose weight to be competitive in high school wrestling, and I didn't want to do that. So out of high school, my story is actually different than most people's story. Most people's story starts with, you know, I was raised in a really poor family and had a hard time when I was young. Well, mine's different. I was raised in a millionaire family. My parents had money and we were very fortunate, and we had all the toys and cars, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful childhood I had with gifts and having money as a family and the best baseball gloves and the best football cleats and the best cars. And all that ended for me in 1988, my senior year. I graduated in 1988 and my parents went broke in 88. Out of them going broke, they had enough money to get me and my brothers into whatever we wanted to get into. My oldest brother wanted a gym. So my dad bought him a gym. My middle brother wanted to go into the drywall business, and he bought him a drywall company with a boom truck and everything. And then for me, I'm 18 years old. I don't really know what I want to do, but we were not going to go to college because we were going to work for the family business. So our grades were horrible. And you know, I wasn't good enough to go pro and with sports. And even if I was, we were told we were going to work for the company of the family company. Well, with the family company going broke, we were like, well, you know, what do you want to do, son? And I'm like, I don't even know what I want to do. So I thought about being like a sports trainer, like, you know, so what kind of, maybe a baseball trainer, a football trainer of some kind, something to do with sports. So the fastest track to that without an education was massage therapy.
Oh, wow.
And I became a licensed massage therapist. I graduated the Atlanta School of Massage in 1989 and took it as a 10-month class, $10,000. And I was going to be a massage therapist. And I was going to, of course, go from that to maybe being a sports trainer, sports massage, whatever. I want to do something with sports, thinking I could get there through massage at first. Well, it ended up being a really good career that I bit off here. But at the same time, it wasn't a career, and I didn't know this yet, but it wasn't a career for an attractive male. It just wasn't. It was, I got women that would come in and see me and cancel their appointment. They would be like insecure that they were fat, or they would have a bump on their back, is what they would say. And their husband would kill them. Things like that. It was really weird that, you know, women will talk a big game like, oh yeah, I want a good looking guy massaging my back. But when it comes down to them taking their clothes off and getting under that sheet,
yeah,
it's a different little story. And I understood that. It was just 10 months too late. I went for 10 months. I went to school, $10,000. I graduated number one in my class to be able to be told that this ain't going to be a career. And so I was really down about it. And I was at my pool at my apartment complex, and Missy Hyatt, a female announcer for WCW, saw me at the pool one day, and she came up to me. She goes, "You know, you should be a wrestler." And I said, "A what?" And she goes, "You know, a pro wrestler. I'm Missy Hyatt. I'm on TV." I said, "Those guys don't make no money." And she goes, "Our lowest paid guy makes $100,000 a year."
Oh, that is crazy.
I said, "What?" So I start checking into it. It was $3,000 to go to a warehouse in Griffin, Georgia, that they kind of called the WCW school. It didn't have no name. It was a guy named Jody Hamilton and a guy named Buddy Lee Parker. Sergeant Parker is his name. And he was the guy that trained guys for $3,000. And they kind of called that the WCW school. But it was $3,000. And $3,000 is a lot of money today. It was a lot of money back in 1990 for sure. And so I came back to Missy. I was like, "Missy, look, man, it's $3,000, you know?" So she found a guy named Steve the Brawler Lawler. It was a guy that kind of looked like Jerry Lawler and kind of went off his fame and made his own name, named Steve the Brawler Lawler. And that guy's who trained me. And so I got into wrestling with the fortunate of meeting Missy Hyatt to get me in the business.
Oh, wow. That is awesome. That's a big journey. Now, were you a fan of wrestling at all growing up, or?
I wasn't. My brothers were big fans, and don't get me wrong, pro wrestling was always on television, but I wouldn't say I was a fan. It was more my brothers. I remember my brother Steve would dress up like Dusty Rhodes, you know, and I remember him talking like Dusty Rhodes and the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, and that, I remember that vividly. But I remember watching the Road Warriors on TV though, and that was always cool because you knew when they came out, somebody's getting beat up, you know, and that was always cool. You know, the Road Warriors were the toughest guys. So I do remember, and of course I knew Ric Flair, I knew the Four Horsemen, and I knew that stuff, but I wasn't a fan. Like, I didn't dress up at Halloween, nothing like that. So I liked it, we watched it, and we knew what wrestling was, but I wouldn't say I was like a fan where I'd buy an action figure or buy a video game. It was more, my brothers were more fans than I was. And for a long time, when I got in the business, everybody thought it was my brothers because they were bigger fans than me. But,
yeah,
you know, 35 years later, you know, Dusty Rhodes actually hires me. So how weird is that? My brother was dressed up like him as a kid. But so, yeah, I wasn't a fan, but I was definitely, it was at first, it was all just about the money.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's why I got in, for the money.
Now, so how was that, you know, when you started going to WCW, you know, going from the indies into something like that, how was it, you know, the transition, how was that different?
The transition was huge. And the transition went from Independence, which was North Georgia Wrestling. I was the Fabulous Fabian. And then it went to Global Wrestling Federation, which was on ESPN, which was a big deal. It was a giant deal because we were on ESPN. We were going to be the third company. There was WCW, there was WWF, and now there was going to be GCW, Global Wrestling Federation. GWF, Global Wrestling Federation. There's going to be three major companies, and we were going to be one of the three. The Patriot, X-Pac, Marcus Alexander Bagwell, or the Handsome Stranger. Raven was there. The Patriot, I didn't say the Patriot. The Patriot, Jerry Lynn was there. Harlem Heat was there. They were called the Ebony Express. We had some talent there. We had some serious talent at GWF, and Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert was there. Some old timers that were great. And so out of that, I really learned a lot there in that 3-month period. I remember getting there and I was horrible at this business. I was not good at it. I couldn't figure it out. And I got to Global, and when I walked in the dressing room, I noticed that the bad guys and the good guys, the babies and the heels, were in the same locker room. And I was like, "Wait a second." I go, "You guys can talk a little bit before going to the rink?" And they go, "Yeah." I go, "I can do this. I'm able to do this." But I had not been trained like that. We were trained to go in the ring and call it out there. And it was horrible. I mean, we were horrible at it. And it's really hard with 12 people there to call a match and not him hear you.
Yeah.
And then, did you hear me? And what'd you say? And whispering, and you can't hear. And you shoot a guy off the ropes. He didn't hear you. And you come off the ropes. And you hit each other. It was horrible. So when I learned that you could talk a little bit and then go to the ring, I went from like a 2 to an 8 because I was able to talk a little bit to my opponent. And then I took that 2 to that 8 and I got really good at this craft. And that 3 months, man, I mean, from going from a 2 to an 8, that's a huge stretch.
Yeah.
And I really did that in that 3 month period. And right when they shut down GWF, WCW called me the same day.
Oh, man.
So I signed a WCW contract for $500 a week to go to school. And 2 days into that, Barry Windham blew his knee out and I went on the road and never looked back.
Now that is amazing.
Yep.
Now for that, with the locker room thing, was it, I know at that time too, there was kayfabe. How was that? How did that, you know, I know your brothers probably knew more because they were bigger fans. How did you have to teach you the kayfabe thing and what you could do, or how,
well,
what was that process?
It's funny, the kayfabe thing. When I went to the other school, the WCW place, the warehouse, I noticed that, you know, Kevin Nash was there that day. And Kevin Nash, I knew Kevin Nash because Kevin Nash was the number one bouncer in Atlanta to all the nightclubs and all the titty bars. And then I was the number one customer to all those places. I was under 21, but I had my fake ID and I was going to all those places. So I knew Kevin Nash very well. He knew me as well too. And we talked at clubs, talking about me trying to get into business, wrestling, and he was definitely gonna get in it. He was 7'1", 350, and a good looking guy.
Yeah.
He was gonna make it, you know? And I was a 5'10", 190 pound guy trying to make it in the business, not quite as easy. So we talked about that. We had that in common. Well, that day they're down at the ring and they're whispering in the ring. So when I came home to Missy, I go, Missy, they were talking about me in the ring. She goes, no, they wasn't. They were calling spots. I go, what's a spot? So they were still in 1990. Kayfabe was huge. Now, my brothers didn't know kayfabe because you had to be in the business to kind of know that back then.
Yeah.
With the handshake and all that. You know the handshake thing, right?
No, I don't.
You don't know the handshake like this? You don't know that? This
no.
is how wrestlers shake hands or did.
Oh.
During my coming up in the business, this is how you shook another worker's hand. If you shook a worker's hand like that, it told the guy you were stiff.
Oh.
So you looked up and did this. Hey, brother. How you doing, brother? And that,
oh,
and
cool.
But during my run, that became a joke. You didn't do that no more. So when somebody would do that, you corrected them. You'd say, don't do that, bro. It's stupid. But for years, that's what you did. You shook hands like that to let the other guy know that you're one of the boys.
Yeah.
But that got so spread out that everybody was doing it. So the true boys thought that wasn't cool. So I didn't make the rule. I just followed it. And that wasn't cool no more. But that was the kind of stuff that you had to learn along the way. And Missy's who was there for me to learn that stuff by going to the locker room and speaking to everybody and saying hello and, you know, being nice. And just, that was something I was a nice guy anyway, but I was going to have a lot of heat on me out of the gate because I was young. I was a good looking kid. I had a good body. So those kind of things aren't the best things to have in this business with your locker room. They're the best things to have to the company, but not to the locker room. There could be heat there, you know, and there was heat, but I remember really being able to zone in on myself and realizing that I was very grateful for the way my parents raised me because I was genuinely a nice kid anyway. So I really got over the locker room. I wasn't this asshole guy they thought I was going to be by the way I looked. I was a down to earth, nice country, well-spoken kid. And it helped me tremendously in the business.
That is awesome. Yeah, thank you for showing me that and telling me that. I didn't know that.
You've never heard the handshake.
Yeah,
though.
I knew it was kind of like, I know with the kayfabe, there was a lot of like how with, you know, Duggan and Sheik, when they got caught, you know, with
yeah,
the weed in the car
and
how big that was. I never knew about the handshake thing.
Huge. That was huge. That really hurt Duggan's career majorly, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was working with Hogan on top, you know.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Now, for you, because you've worked in both companies and I know you went from the indie scene. How is it different, you know, working for, you know, for Bischoff and them and WCW working for Vince and WWF? Because I know your stint was longer in WCW than it was in WWF.
It really was. I mean, I could tell it was going to be roughly the kind of same deal, except with Eric, we were friends with our boss. We rode motorcycles with our boss. Our boss, you know, flew our Harleys across the United States to have them with us to ride to Sturgis on them. You know what I mean? It was our boss was our friend, our good friend. And we loved Eric, you know. So Eric had his little clique of guys, Steiners and Sting and Bagwell and Lugers. And, you know, Eric was just a great boss to have. But Vince was a true boss. Like, he didn't have no friends.
Yeah, corporate suit and tie.
Corporate suit tie, where Eric was one of the boys, kind of, you know. So it was much different. And plus that, I wasn't, like you said, I wasn't there for a month, you know. I mean, what they did to me, man, was horrific. I mean, just how can you take a Buff Bagwell and take an 11-year career and try to put on his resume that we're firing him because his mother called?
Wow.
Or we're firing him because he had a bad match. Either one of those, to me, sounds like maybe a warning.
Yeah, maybe that's a big red flag.
Maybe a punishment. If both those were true, maybe, you know, some kind of fine even, but fired? How do you fire Buff Bagwell for having a bad match? A 5-time world champion tag team wrestler with 4 different guys, that's a pretty good resume. Yeah. And rookie of the year, all that, and still now I'm just 30 years old with my whole life ahead of me. So it was a big deal, and it took a lot out of me, man. And that's where the demons really started coming in with drugs and alcohol.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't know that about, you know, because a lot of times I've seen, you know, before, you know, Bischoff gets a lot of crap and a lot of shit for what he's done.
I always think
with his
him.
Attitudes. I know I've seen that in a lot of stuff. So hearing that different side of, you know, he being, you know, one of the boys and actually treated you guys good versus yep. Vince, that's another side that I've never seen before.
I know. And Eric gets dogged out a lot. And almost every time he gets dogged out, I said, man, I can't hop on that bandwagon with you. I said, man, Eric. I love Eric. He's great because he was always good to me, always good to everybody I've ever seen him be around. Not many people disliked Eric Bischoff while working for him.
That is, I said, thank you for telling me. Yeah. Like I said, it might be a, you know, exclusive for this podcast story.
Eric was a great guy, man. He really was. He was
awesome.
A great guy.
Awesome. Now, do you have any questions about, you know, the Eric or anything that, you know?
I actually had a kind of an interesting question because the more that I watch wrestling documentaries now, you know, where multiple people have been in multiple companies, sure. You know, like WCW, WWE, AEW, TNA, they always talk about the differences in the ring, like how it affected their performance. Whenever you went over to the Federation, did you feel kind of hindered by how the ring was? Because I want to say I've heard stories about how the World Wrestling Federation ring was a bit softer compared to the WCW ring.
Right.
Because I know for a fact that a lot of people hated the 6-sided TNA ring whenever they went into TNA early on.
I've got my input with it, and unfortunately mine's not good because I wasn't in the other ones enough.
Right.
I was in the TNA one a couple of times. And matter of fact, when I did TNA, it was still the square circle. It was still the square
ring. Right, right, right.
I was on their very first show in Huntsville, and it was a battle royal. And it was a square ring. And then same thing with Vince. I was in a ring once, but I went to school for a week. The truth of the rings are WCW's rings 18x18. Vince's is 20x20. Now TNA's, I don't know. I think they were 18x18 as well. But also WCW's ropes were steel cables with a garden hose and tape around. And you tighten them up, and it was literally a steel cable. So when you hit that rope, it's a steel cable you're hitting. And WWF at the time, it was a rope, a real rope. So it was a 2-foot bigger, and it was womp, womp. So the ring was bigger and slower. You hit a WCW rope, it was like, it threw you off. You know, it really would sling you. And it was 2 feet shorter. So if you came from Vince to us, you better get in the ring and play around a little bit. And vice versa. And WWF, if you weren't careful, you go do a leapfrog and you land in front of the guy because you jumped too soon. You know, but at WCW, if you're not getting in motion to go up for a leapfrog while he's at the ropes, you're going to be too late. So it's a 2-foot is a big timing thing. You got to be careful with it. So they put us in school for a week to get used to Vince's 20-foot by 20-foot. And so it was a big deal. And it didn't affect me in the ring with Booker. It just was really big, right? Really big rings. But yes, it ain't like you can just hop in and do your stuff. You got to time out your stuff a little bit more, from arm drags to hip tosses, to tackles, to your drop downs. Everything was, it was a different world.
Big and adjustment.
Big adjustment. Everybody would say that probably, because it just, it was the truth. It was a very big adjustment from ring to ring.
Right. Yeah. I was mainly wondering because, you know, one of your signature moves was going off of the rope.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely. So it was a big deal. It was definitely messed with a lot of people for sure.
Now, with that too, that's something I wanted to ask too, because I know growing up, a lot of people, we pretend to be wrestlers on the trampoline.
Right.
How, and I know there's some people say that they get the smack. It's just the boards underneath there. How is it, you know, being like, is it like the trampoline like we know, or is it actually like hard hitting?
No.
I've always wondered that.
Let's put it this way.
I've actually taken a bump before.
So. Then you know how hard it is. It's crazy hard. Underneath a ring, it still pulls. And they're this way and this way, the poles are. There's there's plywood, and there's a mat about that thick. And that's it. I mean, when you hit, I mean, I went to wrestling school my first night, and I came home, and I was never going back.
This is a
kid that was a Golden Glove state champion boxer. I was a superstar football player, superstar all-county, all-state football and baseball. And a younger brother of three. I got my brains beat out by them. I was a fighter. I was a tough kid. And I went to one night of wrestling school when I came home, and I was not going back. It was that hard. And I don't even know why I went back, but I did. And thank God I did. But it was that difficult to me. It really was like, you got to be kidding me. I can't believe how hard it was. It was really, really, really like blew my mind. Cause like everybody else, they hear, oh, it's like hitting rubber bands and it's like a trampoline. It's not. So anybody that don't believe me, just go down to your wrestling school if you find one somewhere and let somebody pick you up and slam you, and you will think a lot different about the business.
So yes, it's very different than people think. Like, oh, they're just actors. You're an actual, it's actually a tough athlete, not just getting in there and pretending to do it.
It's the hardest business. It's the hardest thing I've ever tried to do in my entire life. I have been not good. I have been great at everything I've tried in my life. Been very fortunate to be great at everything I've tried, and I was horrible at pro wrestling for 6 months. Horrible to the point where I couldn't wrap my head around it. I couldn't believe there was something in this world that I couldn't do. I mean tomorrow I can't hit a golf ball to save my life, but tomorrow if a camera was on me, I can make you think I was a PGA player. I can make you think by the way I warmed up and the way I teed that ball and by the way I got up and sized everything up, you think I've been playing golf for 20 years. I can fit the role. In pro wrestling, it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I've seen pro athletes look like horrible, horrible people in the ring. I've seen guys that couldn't throw a baseball be fantastic at it. It's just a different. It's a different animal. And I'm not saying that because I'm in the business. I'm saying it because it's true. It's truly the hardest thing to be good at. You got to be cool. You got to be a little bit of a nerd. You got to be smart. You got to be dumb. You got to look good. You don't got to look good. It's a little bit of everything all mixed together. And to me, all mixed together equals The Rock. All mixed together equals a Stone Cold. And as close as you can get to one of those two is the best at the business. So it's about having a great body, and it's about wrestling great, and it's also about being cool. There's also several other moving parts that you got to be good at. It's having swag. It's having charisma. It's knowing how to talk, knowing how to shut up. It's just, I've never seen so many things you got to be good at to make a good pro wrestler. It's the toughest business I've ever seen. Really is.
That is awesome. Like, you know, getting to know that side of how hard it actually is, because, you know, like I said, we've always, you know,
seems easy,
it's
right?
Been played off, you know, as you're just faking it in there. It's y'all just acting, you know,
right.
Hearing that act,
easy,
the hardest thing, you know, that's something that
it's
I never would
really,
have thought of.
It's really, really tough. And I'm teaching my niece how to do it right now, and I'm remembering how hard it is. I mean, you know, I'll tell her to do something, and something I just picked up and did, but she ain't quite that good. I mean, it's something either I was better at it or is it just because it's just really hard to do? I think it's a very tough business to be good at. It really is.
Now, something too, I want to hit on as well with that, you know, that the pain and all that, the hardness of it coming. How was that different going at, you know, training it when, you know, you, like you said, you were on the pills and you didn't feel anything. How was that different now that you're sober and you actually can feel what you're actually doing?
Well,
what's that dynamic?
That's a good question. And, you know, of course, all the wrestlers were on some kind of pain medication. All of us were. And everybody had their little regimen. And a lot of guys would take a pain pill and a couple aspirin and a cup of coffee was what you do before a match, because you just get a little energy. It also took care of the pain. But when you're wrestling in front of a crowd, the pain's not there anyway. It's really weird. It nothing hurts in front of that crowd. But you let nobody be in the crowd and take a slam, you're like, oh my God, that hurt.
It's that adrenaline.
It's the adrenaline. It really is. It's that power of that TV, and you're live on TV, and you don't want to look stupid. You don't want to look weak. So you get slammed or clotheslined by Goldberg or speared by Goldberg, and it didn't hurt. The next day, you kind of hurt, but not really till the next day, you know. So it really is, you know. But now being sober, you know, I was sober for the first 5 years of my career. So it wasn't an issue of making my matches better or worse. It was something we figured out along the way that helped us a little bit. It wasn't like a devastating change. It just helped to have a pain pill here and there to help with the pain when you're in the ring. But then when it wasn't there, like it's not there now, it ain't like it makes my match worse. It just makes me be able to realize that, you know, that used to hurt more than it used to, you know. Yeah. It hurts a little worse than I thought.
No, with, you know, back to that character thing too as well. I know with, you know, you weren't there for long, and I know it's way different with, you know, WWF. How was, you know, did you have any input of like your character, like buff the character, or was it kind of they did that for you, kind of this team that, okay, here's this rest, we're going to make this certain character we want, or did you have any input on that?
At WCW, I had all input with it. But at WWF, you know, again, I wasn't there long enough with those guys to really know. I mean, like they didn't want me to talk in the camera. And that's all I did at WCW. You know, was I go out, I talk to the camera, you know, I pose in the camera. I always talked in it and stuff, you know. And the very first match I had with Booker, they said, don't look in the camera. If you look in the camera, you're fired. And I was like, oh my I said, God. Shane, I go, that's all I do. I said, look in the camera. I pose and I wrestle a little bit. I go, that's all I do. And he goes, don't look in the camera, you're fired. So if you watch that match back with me and Booker, I come out and I'm like, you know, trying to dodge that camera so I didn't look at it, you know?
Yeah.
But if you look at the 3 weeks before that match, I was in the camera, look at me, I'm buff, I'm the stuff, you know, right in the camera. So,
oh yeah, a lot of your shots are from, you know, just coming out of the ring.
Sure,
yeah.
Right in the ring, you know, right in the camera. So that was one of my deals that I had to change because Vince didn't like it. Shane didn't like it. So they said, don't look on the camera. So it really threw me off too that night because, again, they didn't like the match. Well, I wasn't myself. I couldn't go out and be myself with the camera. So that was right when my music was playing. Don't talk on the camera. I went, what? I said, Shane, that's all I do, brother. He goes, you can't do it. So I had that going on me. So I looked out the curtain.
That is crazy. Yeah. Now, I know you did other sports before with crowds and stuff. What was that? I know you said the atmosphere is a whole different. So what was the, you know, for you, the different crowds, like working at football versus, you know, a crowd at a wrestling match? What is that dynamic? Or how was that walking out of that stage, you know, as a like a rock star queen essentially to this crowd? How was that different, you know, dynamic?
I think, like, good question. But, like, going out to, like, a Friday at school pep rally. I mean, you can't get much bigger than that, right? I mean, you're the starting quarterback of the Sprayberry Yellow Jackets, and you're going to be coming out to your whole school. At everybody loves pep rallies. So everybody's at the Friday morning, Friday afternoon pep rally for the Friday night game. And you're coming out to Born to Be Wild, you know, and you're ripping the paper come through the paper, you're the big star of the team. And there's not much higher than that. Nitro coming out as Buff Bagwell on Monday Night Nitro is 100 times bigger than coming out at a pep rally. So 100 times cooler. And it was so deep, man. I mean, to know that camera's live and know instead of 2,000 people, there's 20 million people watching. And it was just such a high, man, to be on that live TV show. It was a big deal, and I knew it, and we all knew it, and it was a great, great ride, man. Great ride.
Awesome, awesome. Now, can you talk about that aspect as well? I know we talked about it a little earlier before we got on the podcast here about, you know, that going live and that, you know, that experience is, you know, can you talk about that story about being live?
Yeah, the live thing as a kid, I remember, you know, like watching, I remember watching Evel Knievel one night, and my parents were watching Evel Knievel in the top right-hand corner. I remember you saw those words, the word it said live. And that really affected me. It made me think about the show I was watching much, much differently. I mean, the thing was, Evel Knievel was jumping over a swimming pool and there were sharks in the pool. And I remember thinking to myself, I wouldn't have turned that channel to save my life. I wanted to see if Evel Knievel didn't make it. I wanted to see him get ate by sharks. I wanted to see what happened. I want to see if he fought him off, maybe if he survived, if he got killed. No matter what it was live. And that intrigued me. And so I watched it. And I really thought the same thing about pro wrestling. With it being live or anything being live, football, a boxing match, it just really upped the game because you knew there was no trickery. There wasn't no editing. There wasn't any put that in, put this out, take that out, put this in. There was none of that because that right-hand corner, it said live. And that was always just so cool to me. So live WCW was a huge difference. You couldn't edit out that punch that was missed. You couldn't edit out that bad drop kick. If you threw a bad drop kick on Nitro, you look like shit. If you threw a bad punch, you look like shit. But if you were good, then you looked good on TV. And that really separated a lot of the talent. And I always performed better under live TV.
Because I know, like you said earlier, you know, like you fall and hurt your knee, you know, that's loud on television. You're going to get laughed by the boys when you walk in the locker room.
For example, like when we got the new logo on the ramp, and it was a new WCW logo. And Eric Bischoff wanted everybody to come out of the locker room and walk down the ramp because it was supposed to be slippery. Well, everybody gets up and walks outside to check it out. Me and Luger don't get up. And everybody comes back to the back. Me and Luger don't say a word, playing cards. And all the boys sit down. They go, well, why didn't you guys go out there? I go, well, what were y'all doing? He goes, well, Eric said it was real slippery. We should have looked at it. I said, well, it's live TV. I said, if I fall, I'm going to make it funny.
I think I actually heard a story that Chavo Guerrero ended up slipping on that stage because it was all greased up like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now I probably got the heat for it. Where it was oily or something because of my oil. But it really was the Nitro thing in there. Same thing with the ring. It had that apron, the Nitro thing in the middle of the ring. It looked so cool. But if you were third or fourth, fifth match, all the oil and sweat was on that canvas. And so you'd slip on the stuff. But again, can't practice that.
Right.
You can't go over it. So if I slip and fell as Buff Bagwell, I'm going to make it funny. So that's what I looked at it like. So why would I go out and practice walking down the ramp when I'm going to go out and just be me? It's live. If I slip and fall, I'm going to slip and fall and go, did you see that? I just fell on live TV. That's great. So I'd have made it funny, you know? So it just, to me, what happens, happens, and go with it. That's what live TV is so great.
It actually brings me to another question. Have you ever played any ribs on anybody, you know, like mid-match or anything?
No, not on live TV.
No, no.
Those kind of ribs could be maybe like getting killed. The best rib ever was Davey Boy Smith peed in a syringe one time. A 3cc syringe. Not sure where he got the syringe from, for real, but he had a syringe. And he peed in it. And he put the needle in the bottom of a toothpaste thing of Big Van Vader's.
Oh, no.
And he squirted the piss into Vader's toothpaste. And for the next 2 years, every time Vader brushed his teeth, the whole locker room cracked up. I mean, he was brushing his teeth with Davey Boy Smith piss. That's brutal. I remember vividly him rolling up the toothpaste thing because he made it last that long. So he's squirting out piss in his toothbrush. Now that's a rib, brother.
Well, all the ones I've heard rib. So far have been pretty tame.
That's
crazy.
Rough. that's the most roughest tame rib. But those Canadian boys, that's how they ribbed. They ribbed what we call on the square. Like they ribbed you, but with a little bit of a dent, a little bit of a scratch.
Now we like I said, this show is, we can go as crazy and swear as much as you want. Yeah. So what is the worst one besides that, that you've ever seen a rib that you're like, okay, somebody's going to get murdered over that one.
Well, that,
I feel like you can't get any worse than
that. That's to me, the worst, the worst one I've ever seen was that, I think, but not the nastiest. The nastiest was we got into a shit contest with the Nasty Boys. The Nasty Boys would shit in your bag if you fucked them. And I mean, if you weren't careful, you'd have a big pile of shit in your bag. And I never had it. Another thing they would do is they would lock your bag to the ceiling with a padlock. And you not have the key or the combination to it. And you had to go find bolt cutters to get your bag down. Now, none of those things happened to me, but I saw it happen to a lot of people.
Oh yeah.
And it was bad. I was like, man, I'm sorry, bro. But the shitting in the bag thing was probably the biggest rib that was real bad.
Now, with that same, in that same vein, is there any road stories or on the road stories that you can tell us that are good, bad, or just?
Yeah, the road one was we would get in egg fights. So you get a dozen eggs or a couple dozen eggs and you go down the road. And when a red light happened, you pull the guy's van and everybody would get minivans. That way you could hop out quicker. It went from looking cool in Cadillacs, right, to all having minivans. You could jump out and everybody just egged your car, man. And then it got to be an egg fight. So the egg fights thing, they went on for years. And a lot of tempers got flared, man. Because, the rental cars would get, if they hit with an egg, sometimes the paint would get taken off.
I know Paul Heyman has a thing where he's, I think, one of the car rentals, he's like, banned from ever using them again.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of boys that got in trouble with rental cars, but yeah, the egg thing was huge, man. It was always a big egg fight, and just there was a, we just everybody all the boys were we were bored on the road, so we had to entertain ourselves. And at first it was with golf and bowling, and then it got to be ribs, because we got really bored. You gotta be in the building at 12 o'clock, and we don't go on TV till 8. That's 8 hours with the coolest people in the world under one building. It's kind of not much to do there, And so we have 40-yard dashes, and how many times you could win coin tosses. I mean, cards. We just did everything we could possibly do, but you run out of things to do. And finally, it started being drinking. We started drinking because it just was what ended up what we didn't do next. So I thought, well, look, let's get drunk, I guess. I mean,
Now, I know he was there in the I love him as a wrestler and his story. Did you have any interaction or work with Randy Savage at all while your time there?
Oh, absolutely. I wrestled with Randy several times and he was so great. I love him so much. The interaction I had with Randy was when we were doing the New Blood thing. All the older guys like Macho and Hulk and the older talent guys, your Roddy Pipers, it was going to be the young guys versus the old guys. Really great interviews, dinosaurs, you old timers.
Yeah.
But of course they had better stuff to talk about because they won more belts than we won. So they were better than we were, but on the mic, they didn't want to be called old and stuff. So they didn't like the angle of the New Blood. But one of the interviews I had one time was a scripted out interview I had that I had to dog out Macho Man. And I remember being pretty bad, but I saved the paper in case it caused a problem.
Yeah.
And sure enough, that next Thunder, Macho Man beat me up the whole main event of Thunder because this interview I did on him. And after the match was over, I said, Macho Man, what are you doing, bro? He goes, you need to be careful next time about what you say about me. And I went right to my bag and I showed him the paper. And he goes, oh my God. He goes, I didn't know this. I go, it's too late now though, isn't it? You just kicked my ass on Thunder for the whole 11 minutes. I didn't get nothing. I mean, he beat me up the whole way. The girl drop kicked me. The girls were beating me up. He was beating me up. I didn't get no offensive on, nothing at all. And he did it because he was mad at me. And it was not my fault. It was an interview that WCW Eric Bischoff had me say about Macho Man. And I got beat up on Thunder for it.
Oh my God. Which so, I know a lot of people say that with him, he was Macho Man all time 24/7. That now was, I've seen different videos. Was the voice his voice or that we all know?
I mean, always. Always, brother. It was, always Randy Macho Man Savage. I mean, it wasn't quite that intense, but the voice was always there. Always. I loved it, though.
Awesome, awesome. Now back to, like you said, that one thing we want to get into here on the show too is something that's big for you right now, your sobriety with. So what was that journey, starting that? Because I know you said you had the long time alcohol abuse. How was, starting that journey?
Yeah, well, you gotta realize, man, for a long time we had it down to a science, man. On a great bodybuilder can make a vicious drug addict because we're so scheduled, we're so regimented. And if when you're really regimented with bodybuilding, it makes you regimented as a drug addict. So I would get up and I would do what I call my first party. I would take like 8 pain pills and 16 Somas. And that was just party number one.
Oh, wow.
That was 8 Loratap 10s and 16 Somas. So you did one pain pill with 2 Somas. And you kept doing that with alcohol, no liquor. It was all beer. And that made a big difference. We didn't know this, but beer made a big difference on not putting us over the edge quicker than we went.
Yeah.
But beer kept us kind of tame. But still, we're swallowing 24 pills. And first round, my first party is this. And I had 3 of those a day.
Oh, my God.
So that's 45 Somas a day. And, 8, 16, 20, that's 24 pain pills. 24 pain pills and 40 Somas every single day with a case of beer for 5 straight years.
Oh,
and I made it work. I would go to the gym and I'd get up and on an empty stomach, 8 pain pills, 16 Somas, and I drink beer. And I'd get really messed up. I'd eat my meal. I'd take a nap and get up and go work out. On an empty stomach again was party number 2. 8 pain pills, 16 Somas again with alcohol. Then I would do that, eat, nap, get up, wrestle sober. Because I'm sober wrestling now.
Wow.
And then right after wrestling, 8 and 16 again. And that regiment for 5 years is what I did with a case of beer. And then WCW ended before we learned about liquor. And then it really caved in quick.
Now, at this time, I know that a lot of times it was kind of, at least at WWF with all the other guys, it was like Jake and it was pushed on the rug. Did WCW know about all this going on and kind of just to get you guys out there? Or was it?
Everybody was doing it was the problem. Everybody was doing it. Not maybe to that number, but a lot of guys were doing it to that number. Nobody just talked about it as honestly as I did. I was very open and honest about. I was very open about it then, and so I'm very open about it now. But a lot of guys aren't quite as open, but I really was. They knew it was a problem, but everybody had the problem. So I don't know what they knew. They knew what to do. You couldn't drug test because they were prescription. I had a broken neck, so to me, I was taking what my doctor prescribed for me. Loratabs and Somas. Now, he didn't prescribe 24 Loratabs and 40 Somas a day, but it gets very expensive at $8 a pill and $3 for Somas. That's very expensive, but we could afford it. So that's what we did. It was a very expensive, horrible drug addiction. But WCW, I don't think, could have fixed it at the time. It was too out of control, and it didn't affect anything. By the way, I look. Did I look like a drug addict to you?
No, you look like a god body.
I had a great body. I was in shape. My house was beautiful. My cars were clean. My Harleys were spotless. I wasn't a loser. I was a drug addict, but my shit was in line, bro. I mean, my shit was in order, But I was a drug addict. And nobody knew it, so they'd write me a prescription. The doctor looks like I look like I was totally with it. So they would write me anything I wanted. I was an injured, broken neck pro wrestler that needed pain medication, and they would write it for you. Went like a drug addict going in there. I look like a professional, but I was a drug addict, and it finally the WCW leash is what I call it. Was a great leash to have because. Who's making $1 million a year. I'm not going to blow that, I'm not going to mess that up. So I was always sober when I had to be sober. But when that leash was gone, all of a sudden, there's nobody. I ain't got to be sober to nobody. And now I'm depressed because WCW and WWF is gone.
Yeah.
And so I dove in deeper. And that's when my true problem started, was 2001. And I'd get bad and go to rehab. And I'd get bad again and another rehab and back and forth. And I juggled it the best I could. But, you know, four times I went to rehab. And this time was the fifth time. And this time I really, really got clean. And the first time I've been really excited about it. So this go around, man, I'm 7 months. And, you know, my sobriety date is August 27, 2021 was my sobriety date. I always say that it's August 27th, 2022. Cause it's 7 months, I'm 7 months clean. So, I always get that mixed up, but it's August 27th, 2022. And that is my sobriety date. So I'm 7 months and a couple weeks, sober. And that's a big deal to me. And I really thought I never could do that. I really didn't think I could. I had a pill for everything. I had a pill for a workout, a pill to go to sleep, a pill to wake up, a pill to, you know, a pill to watch a movie. I had a pill for everything. And I thought that was normal, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't normal, but that's what I thought it was normal.
Oh, wow. Now with that, the thing that got you on your road to sobriety, can you talk about, you know, with Dallas and the program and the house that you got, I forget the name.
Accountability.
Yes.
Yeah. It's really a great journey, bro. It started with a devastating car wreck. August of 2020, I wrecked my car and I was screwed up. Xanaxes and Somas and drinking. And I go through the building behind Cumberland Mall and I knock over a MARTA bus station bathroom. I go through the whole building. And out of it came, I blew my bright patellar tendon. I blew it completely out. And I mean, like it exploded. I don't even have one. And then they had to rebuild that. And from that, I got staff and just, I couldn't get it healed. And then I started drinking. So out of that, it was time to get me clean and sober first. So Dallas and my niece, Jonna, they came at me with an intervention and said, look, if you don't get clean, we're out of your life. So I said, yes, of course. And checked into Black Bear Recovery in August of 2020. And August of 2022, the car wreck was 2020. 2 years later, I'm trying to still get clean, you know, trying to go get clean because my knee was all messed up. So this is now, you know, almost 3 years long is this knee's been bothering me. And I'm finally now clean for like 7 months and a couple of weeks. And now we're looking at getting a knee replacement, you know. So everything's really looking good. I'm clean and sober. My knee's the best it's been. And when this happens, I'm hoping to get, you know, back in the ring again.
Awesome.
So, yeah, hoping so.
Yeah, I definitely want to bring that up. Like I said, we also too with, you know, bringing that up. Well, and how was that on, you know, just not just the recovery, but how was the one thing we talk about a lot on the show is mental health and protect your mental health. How did that correspond, you know, with, you know, getting sober and the, you know, your friends coming to you, hey, we need to fix this. How was that? How did that affect, you know, your mental health wise?
It was a big deal, man. You know, mental health is something you used to not ever hear about, but now all of a sudden you hear about it a lot and it's just amazing. I think the reason why you hear about it so much is because people don't use their brains as much as we used to have to use our brains. Now you Google it, look it up online, you know, you YouTube it, you find it on your phone, you find the answer and you don't got to use your brain as much. It just seems like that's part of the reason why all this mental stuff health is happening because we just don't use our brains as much. We go to our phone, GPS, for example, GPS. Do you know there was no such thing as GPS for my whole nine of my 11 years of wrestling on the road? We had to open a map, a map and look at find. There wasn't no GPS to punch the address in. You had to stop three times, no matter where you were going. If it was the gym, you stopped three times and asked. If it was the civic center, you stopped three times and asked. If it was a restaurant, you stopped three times and asked. Nobody knew where you were going. You had to go by a map. It was brutal. Now, we didn't think it was brutal because there was no other way to do it.
Yeah.
But nowadays, y'all can't even think about looking at a map. Y'all just go to your car and punch the address in, and the car takes you there. That ain't how it was, brother. You had to remember where you were at. You had to remind yourself. You had to make notes. All that takes your brain. That's practice for your brain that nobody does anymore. That's why I think mental health is here. But I really think it's a problem bigger now because we don't use our brains as much. Yeah. But the same thing with me, my mental health was bad at the time because of just staying drunk and staying, you know, under the influence of somas and alcohol and pain pills and opiates and muscle relaxers. It was just crazy. You know, the Xanaxes are horrible for your memory. And it's just a big, big deal, man, to have to face. But again, you got to want to be sober. You know, it's not something you just wish to have and you have it. You got to want to be sober. So yeah. I'm very glad I chose to be sober. I'm very glad that Dallas was there for me. And now with Steve, you being my support team and my niece and just everybody that's with me on it, you know, I got a great girlfriend now named Stacy. She's fantastic. And everybody's in my corner and, you know, staying at the accountability crib and all that where Jake got saved and where, you know, where Scott Hall got 10 years added to his life from Dallas. Yeah. So all that said, you know, I'm in a good spot, man. I'm just thankful to be here.
And like I said, I'm glad that you got that. And, you know, now you're here to do interviews and stuff with us now, too, yes. since you're clean and everything. I'm glad to help promote that as well for you.
I really appreciate it, bro.
And also, you know, thank Dallas, too, for letting us use this nice facility.
Right? Nice place, huh? Not too shabby, right?
Now, one thing, too, that I want to ask you, too, when it comes back, you know, like the merchandise stuff, working with, like, I know it's different than WWF. How was it for, like, you know, seeing yourself as, like, a toy or on a T-shirt or, you know, seeing people make hats like your own that you have? How was that, you know?
It was a big deal, man. You know, back when I was getting figures made for me, so back in, like, you know, the mid-90s, there wasn't – every person on the AEW roster, for example, has got an action figure. That ain't how it was back in the early 90s, bro. Back in 95, you had to be somebody to have an action figure. Everybody on AEW has an action figure. And in my growing up with action figures, you had an action figure if you were G.I. Joe. And that's it. Or you were Ken and Barbie.
Yeah.
If you had an action figure, bro, you were somebody. And so when I had my first action figure, it was gigantic. And they had my tattoo right on my arm. And it was just like, it really blew my mind, man. That was the biggest thing. But I will say, the biggest one was when it was on a video game. When I saw myself on TV as a video game cartoon, that was the biggest thing ever. That was like, wow. Yeah, that was huge.
That is so cool.
Yeah, well, it was cool. And my nephews were both me. I was wrestling myself. I'm not sure what game that was, but you could wrestle yourself. So they both, I said, what are y'all doing? And they said, oh, we're wrestling each other, Uncle Mark. I go, but you're both me. They go, yeah, we know. And I was like, oh my God. So wrestling really got bigger than we even knew it was. It gotten out of hand big and we didn't know it. We were the last to find out. We really were, because we were on the road.
Right.
We were the ones getting to be big. We didn't know how big we were actually getting. You know, it was crazy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so
you guys weren't really aware of the whole Monday Night War thing.
No
idea. Or like to that extent.
No idea. Nowhere near to the extent.
That's crazy.
We'd show up at airports and there'd be people there getting our autographs at the airport. We were like, what? Are you kidding? So it really gotten bigger than we even knew.
Oh, yeah. Especially for us, guys like us, you know, who are in our late 20s, you know, that was, you know, that's how we got introduced to wrestling. Like we knew, you know, like Randy in the 80s, but like 90s wrestling is like pinnacle, you know,
huge.
Is when it was like the biggest thing, when it was everybody, even who wasn't into wrestling, knew wrestling.
Absolutely did. No doubt about it, man. It was a great time. You couldn't have sketched out a better time to be in pro wrestling. To be 25 years old in 1995 and to look like a Buff Bagwell and to have a Buff Bagwell character, I'm telling you, I think you have a harder time sketching out an idea, coming up with an idea. I mean, it was really, really bizarre on how lucky all of us were to be on TV at that time. A Goldberg, same thing. The ball head, the look, And that era, I mean, you couldn't think of a better thing. The Rock at his time, Stone Cold. There was a handful of guys that really, really, really were like, wow. I mean, that's incredible, you know. And to me, the Goldbergs and the Stone Colds, but you also had your Hulk, you know, your Nashes, your Halls. I mean, it was just a great time to be a wrestler. It really was.
Awesome. You have another question? I know I don't want to keep you too
long. No, you're good, brother. I love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I had a few, but I mean, so far you've answered every single one of them in your stories. Good. So that's all I can ask for. I love sitting here and I love,
you know. I could talk, I guess, all day. I love the business. I love talking about it. I just had a blast. I do it all over again. I mean, I'm beat up from it, but I'm more beat up over what I did to my own self with car wrecks and through addiction. And that's why I mainly got sober, was because I was mad at myself for hurting myself. You know, I was mad at myself for hurting my knee, and, you know, I mean, I broke my neck in the ring and stuff, but my injuries are from car wrecks. You know, that's just crazy, but they are. So this time I got clean. I'm going to stay clean this time and, you know, just really pass it along and show people that there is a way to get clean and stay clean.
Awesome. Now, what are some, you know, advice or just anything, just life lessons you can tell people who either want to, you know, get into the business or, you know, or just inspired, you know, by your story or sobriety, either one of those two? What is some advice or some wisdom you can give the audience?
The advice I would give was, when I came into this addiction, I wanted to make it something that I thought of that I could tell everybody to do because it was my way that they're listening to, and, you know, lead, follow, or get the hell out of the way, right? That's what they say. Lead, follow, or get the hell out of the way. Well, out of that, you think being a leader is the way to go. But if you really listen to the statement, it says lead or follow or get the hell out of the way. Yeah. So with addiction, I feel like it's important to be a follower. And I've always been a leader. Marcus means leader of men. Alexander means great warrior. And I was a leader and a warrior my whole life. But with addiction, I do feel that you need to follow. Follow somebody that has been clean. Follow the way they did it. And the way I did it was 30 days at Black Bear. I went to an aftercare program, IOP, intensive outpatient, at Tangu in Marietta. And after that, you find a good support team, which Steve Yu is the head of my support team with my niece, Jana. And that's the way I did it. And that's the way that Jake got clean, with the same way I'm going with the accountability crib. He's been clean 8 years now and going. And so my 7 months will be 7 years before we know it. And I hope I save a lot of lives on the way.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Absolutely, man.
Now, anybody who, like, you know, either want to get you on their podcast or, you know, interview you or talk to you, who, you know, who can they go through, or how can they contact you?
The best way to get me is to go to my website is marcusbuffbagwell.com. From there, that'll take you to all my platforms, my Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. It takes you all those places. But also, my email address is marcusbuffbagwell@gmail.com. marcusbuffbagwell@gmail.com. And that's the best way to get me. That's my email address. So check it out. Contact me, and I do, as you know, I do email you back.
Yes, and it is Marcus himself, and he is amazing, guys. You can tell from this whole interview we've had here, guys.
All right.
He said, thank you so much for coming on, and I enjoyed having you on the show.
Absolutely.
And it's an honor to have you, man.
Thank you so much, man. Thanks for having me.
All right, everyone. That's going to be another episode of the Phantom Squad podcast. Would you like to start our outro? We always say, enjoy the madness.
Enjoy the madness.
All righty. Thank you so much. That's going to be another episode, everyone.